It's Thursday, July 5th, 2018. Welcome, broadcasting from behind the lines of the Second Civil War. This is Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I talk to our Capitol muckraker in chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. This week's show, United States Citizen and Immigration Services is creating a new denaturalization task force to strip people of their citizenship. Mass protests against Trump's immigration policies swept the nation this past Saturday. Raging Chicken was on the ground all over the place. Occupy ICE camps expand across the U.S., calling for the end of the agency in the wake of Trump's child separation policies. And bizarrely, or not so bizarrely, 19 high-level ICE agents basically joined the call to get separated out from the ICE Gestapo. Democratic Party says nothing to see here about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's huge upset victory in the New York 14th last Tuesday. That's according to Nancy Pelosi and her folks. DNC chair, however, Tom Perez says, you know, told Bill Press, no, Ocasio-Cortez represents the future of the party. Okay. Then we see the shakeup in the New York Democratic machine with Julia Salazar's run for the state Senate. Could she be the next Ocasio-Cortez? Bronx Democratic Party machine decides, well, they better get their shit together, have a big meeting, and does not invite Ocasio-Cortez or the other upstart progressive state senator Gustavo Rivera to the meeting. That's interesting. Tammy Duckworth says it's just a Bronx thing. Won't play in the Midwest. Just a reminder, Bernie Sanders won the Democratic Party in North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas, and the entire Pacific Northwest and Mountain States. But we'll forget about that for the moment. Doesn't play well with that narrative, does it, Tammy? Democratic Party leadership sounding similar to the line taken by donors and Wall Street lobbyists, according to some of the discussion for The Intercept. We'll get into that. I just want to mention a cool episode of This American Life a couple weeks back called It's My Party and I'll Try If I Want To. Follows the Jeff Beals campaign in New York 19th, provided a kind of cool look into the behind-the-scenes struggle inside the Democratic Party. An actual headline from Politico this week read, Illinois' governor breaks with Cruz over Nazi candidate. The craziest part about this, you don't know who's pro-Nazi or not. In the wake of the Janice Viasmi ruling, Labor Notes releases a new organizing guide called Rebuilding Power in Open Shop America. Seems like required reading for the labor movement right about now. And a little late to the game, Princeton economists decide, well, we're going to release a report now, finding that unions actually have a historic role in helping address income inequality. Goodbye, Anthony Kennedy. And Monday, Trump is expected to announce his pick for the Supreme Court. Three judges lead the pack, Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Raymond Kethledge. Amy Coney Barrett was actually ruled, I think it's the 7th District, saying that, you know, Roe v. Wade, we don't need that anymore. Meanwhile, Governor Cuomo signs an executive order up in New York, executive order banning the release of state workers' personal contact info in the wake of the Janus decision. Another judge in Michigan rules that children do not, in fact, have the fundamental right to learn how to read and write. I kid you not. New tool from ProPublica allows you to see if your school, college, or university has been investigated for civil rights violations. Look it up now. Link in the show notes. And this just in, literally before we started recording, ProPublica outed a white nationalist who is a PhD student at UCLA and who has U.S. government security clearance to work on sensitive research for a defense contractor, Northrop Grumman. That's always great. Closer to home here in Pennsylvania, Judy Swank compares Burke's Immigration Family Detention Center to her grandchild's daycare facility. Except, of course, the kids' daycare centers get to go home and every night. Senator McGarrigle, one of the prime sponsors of Libra's Law, a bill that protects animals, rides an elephant in the Springfield 4th of July parade. Animal rights activists are notably pissed. Lou Barletta had Nigel Farage, you know, the Brexit dude, as a special guest at his fundraiser this past week. Meanwhile, Dalen Leach becomes the latest Democrat to go on to Matt Brulette's podcast, and Democrats continue to give him clout within the party. We're going to talk a little bit about what that's all about. And so what we think is pretty a failed strategy. And Kevin Mahoney, that's me. I was in Wilkes-Barre, Sean was in Harrisburg, Seth was in Brooklyn for the Families Belong Together marches. And a group of faculty from Pashi, finally, right, from Pashi University, they're raising money to file an amicus brief in support of Colleen Bradley's case. We're going to have information on their GoFundMe site. It's called Help Us Ask the Supreme Court to Stand Up for the First Amendment. Thank God. On a serious note, on today's last call, I want to send love to an old college friend and roommate of mine, Ben Tesler. Ben died unexpectedly this week. My thoughts are with his family's kids. And with all my friends who were equally shocked when we heard the news from one of Ben's best friends, one of the good friends from college, Mike. Ben, rest in peace. It's still a shock. Next week, we're going to have some special content for you, and I'm going to be down the shore. I'm hoping to stop by three breweries to stock up in the fridge. 7 Mile Brewery in Rio Grande, just outside Wildwood. Cape May Brewing, and one I'm most excited about trying to get to is Cold Spring Brewery, also in Cape May. Free Will's got a nice sour edition, the Creek Nouveau, which is out, and round two is actually headed into the tank. I'll have some info on that. It's really good. I'm going to remind everybody that yours truly and from Raging Chicken Press is teaming up with Colleen Fitzgerald from A Home Stony Run to bring you our new podcast, Free Range. Free Range focuses on food, politics, and communities of resistance. We're going to have our next episode coming out either next week or the beginning of the following week, depending on my Wi-Fi connection next week. We have some stuff. We're going to be posting all of our show updates and information about the project to our Facebook page. Just look for Free Range on Facebook. And you can also check it out on our home at freerangepod.com. Remind everybody, tune into the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. Or tune in the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. If you missed the show, just go to ricksmithshow.com and click on the Free Speech icon in the sidebar, or check out the archives directly at freespeech.org. Want to give a special shout out and thank you to Shanna, who became our newest member this week at the $10 a month level. Thank you so, so much. And I want to also say thank you to all the folks up in Wilkes-Barre who told me how much they love Raging Chicken. A particular shout out to Sue, who was the rabble-rouser extraordinaire in the crowd. If we want a progressive future, we need a progressive media, and you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. If you're not ready to become a member, no problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org and click on the big blue donate button right in the sidebar. With the 2018 midterms right around the corner, we need to make sure to help keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. And best way to do that is become a member of Raging Chicken Press by going to patreon.com/rcpress. And Sean, you know, I should have mentioned this right up front. Happy birthday, Raging Chicken Press. 7 years, man. It's our seventh birthday.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
It's pretty amazing. You know, Sean has been with this project since right at the beginning, man.
Yeah.
It's been quite a run.
Yeah, I can't believe it's been 7 years since this all started. And we could thank Governor Tom Corbett for that, I guess, and his cuts and attacks to public education and higher education and labor and everything. And
that's what got it all started. I mean, it was
the attacks in Wisconsin. Yep.
So we founded Raging Chicken Press right in the wake of the Wisconsin uprising after the 2010 midterm elections, in which the Tea Party took over. And and this was our little way of basically trying to expand progressive media in the state of Pennsylvania. And because we recognized there was nothing out there. I mean, there were pockets of kind of good stuff happening in Philly, some stuff in Pittsburgh, but really kind of just like scattered kind of media throughout the rest of the state. And Raging Chicken has from the beginning has been an attempt to broaden that out. And I'll tell you, I was a bit naive about how fast we could grow. I mean, frankly, I thought this would be an easy sell to a lot of folks. But, you know, it's been a fight every step of the way to basically convince people, say, look, this is worth actually supporting. This is actually worth contributing to. This is worth actually, you know, becoming a member of and saying, you know, the progressive media needs to be supported by the progressive community. So, you know, we've also partnered. We've been, you know, worked with Rick Smith and Rick Smith Show since right from the get-go. And, you know, Rick has been fighting this even longer than us about kind of attempting to build out this stuff. And I can't tell you how important it is that, you know, people, if you really want to fight back, is that it's not enough just to have some national media outlets. We need to support progressive media in the state, right in our backyard. You know, in this past weekend when we saw all the immigration protests, this is like a testament, a little glimmer to what we could do if we had the kind of support of the progressive community, people stepping up just to become a member of Raging Chicken for as little $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress, become a member. And I'm telling you that what we can do is limitless if we get the support of the progressive community. Otherwise, you know, we do what we can with what we can and how, and you know, the time that we have. But, you know, we'll see. So 7 years, happy birthday, Raging Chicken Press. Thank you, Sean, man, for all your work over the course of the years. It's been amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, you know, do we need to say it's been a crazy week once again? I'm guessing, yes, it has been. What should we start with, man?
I guess the attacks on immigrants.
How about that?
They're still going on. I mean, it's pretty scary that we're now getting to the point where we're looking to go after immigrants who are actually U.S. citizens and try to strip away their citizenships for petty crimes and deport them for something like a misdemeanor.
It blew my mind. Is that, you know, we see that's this story coming out of you know, this is like New York City studios, right? Kind of like public media in New York City. To see that the stuff, it blew my mind, right? So here is that they're creating a new task force and its goal is to examine what they say are bad naturalization services. The organization expects to hire dozens of lawyers and immigration officers in the coming weeks to find U.S. citizens they say should not have been naturalized, to revoke their citizenship and eventually deport them. I mean, this is astounding. You're going to spend all these government resources to find needles in haystacks, right? Of who knows what technicality they're going to find to export existing people and strip them of their citizenship. I mean, this is astounding.
Yeah. And this is the type of thing where it's, you know, we've seen these, you know, call them what they are, concentration camps go up over the past few weeks within speedy, you know, pretty much like up with, you know, instantaneously, like the way like light infrastructure with these camps we're putting the immigrants we're trying to deport people, and now we're going after people who are naturalized citizens. Like, where does it stop after that? I mean, this is like that going into the abyss type of stuff. Like, you know, when we start stripping people of their rights, we're not giving them any due process, and now we're going after naturalized citizens. What is the concern? Like, where do people say enough?
Yeah, I can't remember. I was reading an article last week about this, and I just can't remember where it was, but I think either in the title or what the discussion was, I think they were dead on about this. These are the kind of things that is like the stress test for democracy. I was like, you know how they do these things like in the financial sector, they want to do a stress test for the bank to see how vulnerable they are to kind of like collapse and all this stuff. This is like one that is being constantly being tested in terms of what's the staying power of our democratic institutions? What's the staying power of a country that is supposed to be doing in the name of people, all of us together in this kind of like pluralistic society, as opposed to rabid white nationalist? And man, the jury is still
out. Where's like Chuck and Nancy at on this?
Chuck and Nancy.
We really don't see them calling out the white nationalism that's running rampant within the Trump administration right now. Two of the most powerful leaders within the Democratic Party.
No, well, you know, the most important thing right now, Sean, is that that they, you know, make sure that everybody knows that the socialists aren't coming. That's more important.
Or that, you know, Maxine Waters shouldn't be saying what she's been saying.
Right, exactly. Got to discipline their own, not kind of develop strategy of kind of resistance and stuff like that. But
that's where the biggest failing is going to happen, is when the people leading the Democratic Party don't stand up and don't fight back against this stuff. Like, you don't see Democrats decrying the stuff like, oh, it's just another news story with Trump looking to revoke people's citizenships. Who's go after you're an activist, or you're a trade unionist, or you're some other like laborer. We're going to strip your citizenship away as a natural born citizen, and try to, and you don't have the rights as anyone else.
Right. Well, I think we should get, like we did last week too, as well. I think we should give some credit to some of the Democrats who are actually stepping up. Like we mentioned Jeff Merkley before, right?
Kristen Gillibrand stepped up.
Pramila Jayapal stepped up, right? Even Kamala Harris has been kind of like,
Bernie Sanders finally came out and said to abolish ICE. I mean,
this stuff is important. It's
the fact that you have United States senators saying that we should be abolishing ICE and completely rethinking the way we do our immigration system. It, we talk about this all the time, but it shifts that Overton window, right? You have, like, this is the perfect example of this. You have a fringe group, right? Like DSA, like other organizations, they put out this fringe idea, like, no, ICE should be abolished. And, people within the DSA and like other left groups have been saying this for months now. And now what's happening along the border, you finally have, like, that was when the dam broke. You had a couple of House representatives saying we should be abolishing ICE. But, the House is the people's House. It's a reflective upon people's attitudes. You're going to get more radical responses from people on both sides. But once, like, a senator or two or three starts saying, you know what, we actually should consider abolishing ICE, that's when the conversation is really beginning to be had.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, like, the fact that, like, three United States senators saying, we should actually abolish ICE and completely revamp, or we try to rework the way we do our immigration system, is extremely important.
Yep.
And that's with or without Pelosi and Schumer.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is pretty amazing. And I thought there was this interesting story, which you mentioned in the headlines today, where you even have some members. This shows you about how. Well, it shows you, it's a window into like a whole lot of things. Right. So there's these 19 ICE agents. They're these high level ICE agents that are part of basically Homeland Security. Because remember that ICE did not exist. Right.
Until 2003. Like,
right. Exactly. So it was only because of 9/11. Right. That we saw the reorganization of all these intelligence services and all this stuff, all under the auspice of national security, that you had the, Immigration and Naturalization Services, which was basically, it was a bureaucratic process of having people kind of come in and kind of follow paperwork and come in. Then there was the kind of Border Patrol, which was kind of separate, like patrolling the borders. ICE was founded as this kind of national security wing, right? And originally, well, I shouldn't say originally, but there's part of this agency, part of ICE, are these folks that are the ones who are actually looking to find out, to investigate cases that there might be, say, terrorists or actually real national security threats that could be attempting to kind of use immigration channels to get into the country, right? And it's a small part of ICE as a whole, right? But the crazy thing is they wrote a letter basically to Kristen, what's her name? The woman from Homeland Security. Why can't I think of her last name?
I know who you mean.
Yeah, okay, thanks for the help. But no. Yeah. But I'm sorry, I'm just spacing her name right now. But wrote to the head of Homeland Security basically to say, look, we've got this problem, right? Our job is to, narrowly focus on like potential terrorist threats or national security threats. And we're having a problem doing our job because the rest of this agency are a bunch of freaking like right wing, they don't say it like this, but it's basically this Gestapo, because of what you're doing, the rest of this agency is doing all this enforcement stuff and rounding up kids and all this other kind of crap that we see the past couple of weeks. Nobody, like local administrations, states, and things like, won't work with these people because they have to. They think they're part of the of the Trump kind of like shock forces, and so they keep on saying, no, look, we're different than those people, right? And they're spending all their time trying to convince local like police departments and stuff that they're not the bad guys. So they're actually appealing to separate themselves out from the rest of ICE. So that's been crazy. And the fact that kind of the abolition of ICE is now becoming, just like you were saying, more of a mainstream kind of Democratic Party push, or at least more open kind of component of the party.
I think it should be a purity test for 2020.
Yeah, why not? Why not, right? I mean, in the face of what's going on right here, there's no doubt.
I mean, like, yeah. I mean, and one of the things I look about this with the abolition of ICE is that, like, you know, like the right has spent years trying to go after the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right, right.
And, like, they're, like, people in the argument, like, well, we can't do that. Well, yes, you can. Look what they did to an actual institution that was built to protect people and not rip people out of the way from their families.
Right.
You can damn well do this.
Right.
It's the political will and courage to wanting to do it.
Right. And, like, you know, people want to talk about this as crazy. Let's not forget that part of the, you know, part of, like, it was almost like a purity test on the right during the last presidential campaign about, like, okay, which government agencies are you going to abolish? Right. I mean, we got the last two Republican. Right. The EPA and I forget.
Department of Energy.
Right. The Department of Education.
Yeah.
Right. Good old Ricky boy down there in Texas. Right. Couldn't even kind of remember his talking points on which agencies he wanted to abolish. And not the 2016 election, but the 2012. You know, this is not. Like, people, they're openly talking about abolishing agencies, like that longstanding ones on the right. We're talking about an agency that was set up for national security purposes, which has gone out of control. So that's crazy. And let's be clear. And it's not for, like, financial reasons, because it's cost too much. It's because it's actually violating people's human rights, right?
Yeah.
Stripping kids away from families. Right. And being the kind of front line of the kind of like resurgent white nationalism on the border. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It is a government sponsored terrorist group. So there we go. It was cool to see this past weekend, however, 750 plus protests across the nation. People coming out all over the country from large cities. Obviously, you had, like, mass protests in Washington, D.C., and New York City, and Chicago. I think Chicago may have had the largest of all the demonstrations. Los Angeles, also huge turnout for these protests against the policies.
It's amazing seeing, once again, another demonstration in D.C. that, like, has over 300,000 people there. I mean, like, these are some, like, it's something I was thinking about, like King's "I Had a Dream" speech, that rally, civil rights rally. You know, there was only 100,000. Was there more than, like, 100,000 people there, or was that, like, the largest rally in the country's history up until, like, the Women's March?
It may have been. Yeah.
We've surpassed, like, 100,000, 300, 250,000 people. Within three or four times already within this past, like,
within 2 years.
I mean, like, the Women's March, the Keep the Families Together March, and then the Gun March a couple months ago. I mean, people are coming out, and I guess we'll talk about this more in the second part, but, like, one thing that's amazing is seeing all the people coming out in cities like Lancaster and Harrisburg and York and, you know, Scranton and Wilkes-Barre and Pittsburgh and stuff like that. We're not Pittsburgh, but, like, places where, you know, usually don't see Democrats out there protesting.
Right.
Or people on the left out there protesting, where they have been the past couple of years. So it's been.
No, exactly. I think, you know, if on one hand, you know, I was talking about before about how we see this kind of as this democracy stress test that's going on. On the flip side of that, we also have kind of, you know,
a constant wave of people, like, mass protests. Like, it's like almost like that, the Francis Fox Piven.
Yes.
Way of, like, mass upheaval that causes change, not like that Alinsky approach where it's, like, you know, transactional organizing and transactional activism, but more along the lines of, like, this is like that we're having mass protests, mass rallies around the country right now. I'm not going to say, like, they're not trying to, like, go after the two different schools of organizing, but, like, people are coming out en masse is what my point is to cause change.
No, exactly. But I would argue here too as well is that we see that something that we get in, like, this is an uprising. Is that's not Smucker. I always
Engler.
This. Engler, thank you. The Engler and Engler book, right? This is an uprising. In that book, right, they say that, look, there's been this kind of false back and not false thing. You have the kind of Francis Fox Piven thing about mass mobilization, right? Things, and then you also have the Alinsky school about building power and institution. And this is an uprising. The argument there is like, look, both of these things are absolutely critical. And they, if instead of these being like two separate and distinct schools, we should be thinking about them together. What I found amazing about what we've seen since, like, you know, since the Women's March, right? I mean, even before that, we got to be clear, even before that, when there was organizing that was going on, what people have been doing has been, yes, this mass mobilizing, but they're also building local power.
Through the DSA chapters.
Exactly. So this is like, I mean, in my mind, we're in this historic sweet spot, if you will, that, you know, again, I have all the hope in the world for, and not hope that's based upon, hey, I hope this works out. But what, you know, people are doing the work, man, of building power, which is absolutely incredible. And they're turning out for these mass mobilizations. So,
yeah.
Crazy, man. So let's contrast that for a second. So what we saw, you know, the turnout here, and like Sean was saying in our second segment, we're going to talk a little bit about where we were on Saturday, some of the local organizing and that kind of stuff. But, you know, we're also seeing this shift and this power dynamic getting played out within the Democratic Party, both locally and kind of and nationally. And it's kind of come to a head, or I don't know, head is the wrong word. It's been brought into the spotlight, I guess, due to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's huge upset victory last week, right? Kind of ousting Joe Crowley. It was that, you know, the number three Democrat was supposed to take over for Nancy Pelosi, you know, had the blessing from the Democratic Pope, I guess, or whatever, to take on that leadership stuff. But since then, it's been almost like a nonstop, like, you know,
24/7 attack.
Yeah, well, attack and rationalization and qualification.
Delegitimize her. She's not from the Bronx.
Well, it's interesting, though, right? Because, like, they're savvy enough, like Democratic Party operatives, like I'm talking like leadership folks here, not kind of grassroots folks, but like, well, some grassroots folks do. But, you know, like leadership thing. I think that a lot of them are smart enough to see that they can't like openly attack her. Right. Although some of them aren't so smart, but like Nancy Pelosi and things like this. She's not
progressive.
Well, look, Nancy Pelosi is smart enough as a political operative, right, to know that what she's seeing in Ocasio-Cortez's victory is powerful. And so what Pelosi and some of the leadership are going to attempt to do, right, and that you'll see this in some other language, is basically to find space within this kind of narrative without disrupting the existing power structure of the DCCC or the DNC or the party itself. Right. So Nancy Pelosi has come out and basically said her first thing, because, you know, basically the questions that came to Nancy Pelosi first after the victory were like, so like, Nancy Pelosi, tell us, is socialism ascendant in the Democratic Party? Right. First of all, a question that, you know, was not even on the radar of possible questions that could be asked, right, in a major press conference, are now some of the first questions that are being asked. Right. So, and Pelosi's basically having to respond to that. And her first thing was like, no, I don't know. That's just the Bronx, right? Which is echoed by Tammy Duckworth and others throughout this past week.
Which I know, I think some people have seen that as like a dog whistle, too.
Totally.
Yes.
Totally.
Like a Kenzo.
That's just among the brown and black folk down there in the city.
Like Kenzo Shibata from Chicago, who works for the Chicago Teachers Union, does social media stuff. He's absolutely awesome to watch on Facebook and Twitter. And he said, like, as a fellow Asian American, from Tammy Duckworth, like, the dog whistles here is pretty remarkable coming from a Democrat. Like, but the thing is, it's like how wrong that narrative is,
right?
Because there's a lot of poor white folk out in central Pennsylvania who absolutely love Bernie Sanders and absolutely love John Fetterman.
Right.
And absolutely love the messaging that Ocasio-Cortez brings to the fold.
Exactly. I mean, you know, like, again, you see a lot of the narrative, they're attempting to kind of say that this is only, you know, again, not only do you see dog whistling, right? You also see this idea about coastal politics, right? Because it was what Tammy Duckworth said, right? It was echoed in kind of all over kind of like the mainstream media this past week, was kind of like, look, that's fine for the Bronx, but that's not going to play well in the Midwest.
Which is absolute bullshit, because if you look at the history of the Midwest, some of your biggest socialist organizations or socialist power came from cities like Milwaukee, came from cities like Madison, came from cities like Chicago. I mean, like, this isn't coastal elite politics. This is like, I mean, like, these states that, like, you know, what are they? North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, West Virginia, Oklahoma, Nebraska, Kansas. They all went for Bernie Sanders, but they all have a history of some sort of like support for socialist ideas and socialist candidates going back into the 1920s. 19-teens, 1900s, like 1930s.
No, I mean, you took the whole populist movement, right? I mean, the farm labor, like that, you know, this the farm labor Democrats up in Minnesota, right? It's not just like the Democratic Party because of the populist movement, because of the lines. In Wisconsin, we saw, you know, where was the first time you had public sector unions, right? Kind of rise up, and you know, that was Wisconsin, right? I mean, you have these deep kind of progressive traditions within these states, which have, you know, have been atrophying in many ways, and I would argue in part because of some of the politics we see at the National Democratic Party. But there's a whole bunch of other complex reasons for that, which is, you know, billionaire assaults from the right. I mean, that's a huge part of this. But we have to remember that. You know, like this
Paul
is something
Wellstone.
That. What's that? Yeah, Paul Wellstone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
I mean, yeah. Like,
I hate to put it like this, but I think it is true, is that what you see on the coast often get kind of like held up as like, look, this is like where, you know, the true liberals are. I would like put some pressure back on that. I say, but yeah, okay, you may have this kind of idea about liberal thought in general on the coast, but it is also where that kind of a particular version of that power is entrenched, right? Because that's where the concentrations of money are, right? But if you look at the traditions of like some of the most progressive, the
Haymarket fire, the riots.
Exactly. Like, I mean, you could just go down the list of movements. And this is something that Sarah Kendzior has been calling attention to, like, since like mid 2000s, right? In her writing.
I mean, like, it's also like the type of thing, like the 8-hour workday didn't come out in New York City or Philadelphia or Boston. No, it came out in Chicago because a riot happened because of it.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, like some of the biggest like labor battles didn't happen in like, you know, the railroad strikes and stuff like that, or was it Pullman? No, not Pullman.
Pullman strike.
Was that the one where, like...
Which one?
I'm trying to think of some of the strikes where, you know, laborers were actually gunned down and killed.
Oh, my God. I mean, where do you start?
I mean, like, a lot of that stuff happened in, like, Pittsburgh.
West Virginia.
West Virginia.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Colorado. Like, I mean, it's... Yeah.
And let's not forget...
Utah, for crying out loud.
Well, and let's see. And are we so far removed? What's baffling to me... Right. What's baffling to me in the midst of right. Like, let's not even think about like long term history. Let's remember that just a couple months ago, we're all championing these kind of massive teacher strikes. Right. In exactly
Colorado,
those states,
Kansas,
right? Exactly.
Oklahoma,
West Virginia. Right.
Like
these were places, Oklahoma. Right. I mean, we're, you know. I don't know. Maybe you're telling me it's not going to play well in these states when they're the ones. These are teachers.
Calling
these
wildcat are strikes and shutting down the school systems.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. Because the existing avenues have basically been exhausted. So, you know, let's keep our head in the game here, people, when we start to do this. And, you know, if you think for a second that the left, right, the kind of the Bernie Sanders people that have come out here, the DSA people that have been mobilizing, right, the kind of progressive Democrats, right, that have been kind of pushing in the party for decades now, haven't had a major role in those things happening, you're nuts.
So,
right?
Oh no, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so, I mean, I think that we need to take all this stuff kind of like with a grain of salt when we see this play out on kind of mainstream media, especially cable news and that kind of stuff, is that these are people attempting to control a narrative. But if we can just keep our memories active enough that we can even think like a couple months back, we got to rethink what we're
and
talking
I think,
about
I
here.
I think like what these people are afraid of, like so last night I was at a 4th of July party with a bunch of fellow like leftists, and we were all drinking beer all night and debating politics and stuff like that. And like, one of the arguments I made, like, the Democratic Party and these officials right now are scared for their lives.
Right.
And they're not just scared because it's like the Democratic Party is ripened for like a Jeremy Corbyn style takeover. Because, like, let's just talk about, like, Labour in Italy, in England, was a neoliberal party, like the Democratic Party, for the past, like, 20 years, 15 to 20 years. I mean, it was a neoliberal party when Tony Blair was the head of Labour. And what happened? Jeremy Corbyn came in, and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn doesn't have an overwhelming majority of Labour supporting him. He has the working people of Labour supporting him, the activists in Labour, and enough to give him, like, a firm majority to keep him as the head of Labour. And that is, like, what I see happening with the Democratic Party. It is ripened for someone like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren to take over. And I think we're starting to see that translate on local politics and locally, where you have people like millennial socialists are taking over. You had a feature in the New York Times with Sarah Namorado, Summer Lee, Elizabeth Fiedler and Ocasio-Cortez about millennial socialists taking over the party. And
exactly.
I mean, like, it's that's the future of the party. And they're that neoliberal wing of the Democratic Party. We're watching that crumble right now. And yeah, they're not knowing how to react to it.
Right. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's going to be important for kind of like people, progressive communities, leftists, like, you know, radicals, is that we have to kind of like dispel magical thinking. Right. And this is what I mean by this, because you see this happen all the time. Look at someone like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and she's an amazing politician. Right. She's incredible. 28 years old. Unreal. Right. In terms of what she brings here. But it's not as if it's because of just the force of her personality that came on. Then suddenly magically people were, were convinced that this is what the direction we need to go. For the same thing that we were talking about before, like earlier on, about like groups like Indivisible, groups like Justice Democrats, groups like Our Revolution, groups like DSA. These are the folks that are building this local kind of like groundswell. And every time that Ocasio-Cortez has been saying, well, you know, the people ask her questions, well, how did you do this? She immediately points back to everyone else and she'll tell the story. She was not even going to run. She was not even thinking about running. It was the Justice Democrats, right? This is Cenk Uygur's group, right? The Justice Democrats that basically came out and kind of recruited her and said, you know what? You should run and we will help support you. And then it was other groups like the DSA, right? that did the organizing from the ground up. So they deserve so much of the credit for this, not just some sort of magical wave that is taking over the nation. No, it's hard work and organizing.
And also it took people to recruit Summer Lee and Sarah Namorado and Elizabeth Fiedler to run. You know, you go back to the Progressive Summit. We're like, yes, no, we were asked, like, I think Sarah with her group, she was like asking people to run. And person she asked, like, no, well, why don't you run?
Yep.
And I mean, Dan Ezra Moroff, who is Summer Lee's campaign director, recruited Summer to run. Like, I mean, like, these are people who are being recruited to run by local activists, and it usually takes a bunch of times. And look what happened.
Yes, exactly. Because, you know, and this is the kind of thing, too, is you look at people like this that are active and that are, you know, are good at what they do and the organizing. A lot of the work is spent in kind of like looking for other people to run. And what some of these other organizations are saying, hey, you know what? I think you could do this. And, you know, someone like you hear like Ocasio-Cortez talk about this and she's like, you know, that hadn't even occurred to me. You know, it's kind of like, really? I mean, I was building power, building organization. And then it took somebody, you know, took this organization. Hey, you know what? I think you got a shot in this. I think we can, and we will help you do this.
I know the funny thing was Joy Reid put out a tweet last year saying, you know, enough with this bull crap. I'm paraphrasing obviously, but enough of this bull crap is saying you can win races without taking corporate cash.
Yep. There you go. Joy Reid. 2018, right?
It's like, yeah, summer 2017. And then Ocasio-Cortez back then said in August 17, like, oh, I'm doing it. I'm going to win.
Yep. And there she is. Winning.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just introduce this. Here's something I've been keeping active, kind of like on my screen, so to speak, and kind of in my mind as I'm listening to a lot of this discussion from Democratic Party leadership and kind of like talking heads online. So this is something that came out from the Intercept, This is, let me see when it was actually came out. Yeah, this is June 27th. Okay. This is right after, Ocasio-Cortez won her primary against Joe Crowley. And I want you to hear some of the voices from lobbyists and business friendly pundits. Okay. So this is, again, this is from The Intercept. So here, quote, "Joe Crowley is a great guy to have a pint of Guinness with," lamented Republican lobbyist John Fahir, I don't know, on Twitter. "For me personally, it's losing a mentor and best friend." Mervyn Jones, a former Crowley staffer who is now a lobbyist for Anheuser-Busch InBev and other clients, told Politico. Quote, "All my best to the Crowley staff," tweeted Rory Cooper, a Republican at lobbying firm Purple Strategies. Okay. Okay, next one. Quote, "If you are in business and if you're watching this from a financial perspective," said political reporter Ben White on CNBC, quote, "it means that Democratic House is going to be liberal, more inclined to block the president." White predicted that Democrats would move more aggressively now to repeal President Donald Trump's tax cuts and oppose administration's deregulatory agenda. Several Democratic pundits appeared on Fox Business Network to raise the alarm about the election. Quote, "The party is swinging left," said Robin Biro, a former Democratic National Committee delegate who supported Hillary Clinton. Quote, "It's concerning for someone who is more moderate like myself." Right. And it just goes on and on. You talked about the third way people and all these people coming out saying exactly this.
I think we're going to talk about this more in the second half, especially with Dan Leach and going on Breer's podcast. But like you can see it here in Harrisburg. It's like where these people aren't seen as adversaries, but they're seen as friends.
Right.
And, you know, like the people, like these Republican lobbyists are friends with like the Democrats, and they want to get their agendas through, and they're not seen as adversaries because everyone's part of that institution.
Absolutely.
And that it's that revolving door politics. It's, you know, it's like the same reason why you have Democrats going on a podcast funded by the Koch brothers and stuff like that, because they're seen as chummy with the other side, even though that side is doing everything they can to kneecap the people who fund your political career.
Yep.
And to fund the political movements that you care about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there you have it. I mean, I think it's, you know, this is an exciting moment, everybody. I mean, this is an exciting moment. I'm a yes, it's hard work. And I'll talk more about this in the next segment, but, as a reminder that we got to take care of ourselves too, as well, right. Make sure that, we don't get burned out, that we're in this for the long haul. As exciting as this is, we got to make sure that we can keep momentum and keep moving forward. It's great. This is one of the reasons why, you know, last week, you know, Sean and I talked about on the podcast, there's a series of Supreme Court decisions that were just so bad. I mean, you know, you had from obviously the Janus versus Aspy ruling, which we talked about here. Talk another ruling that was basically going against, you know, basically allowing, you
right
know,
of contract.
I'm sorry, what?
Like the right of contract going back to like Lochner.
Going back to that, we're talking about the Supreme Court upholding the ability of kind of family planning clinics not having to be family planning clinics. They can just basically lie to clients. That was also a huge move. supporting of the kind of the Muslim ban. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff bad happened there. But in the wake of this, I was so happy to see this week that Labor Notes just released its new organizing guide, and it's called Rebuilding Power in Open Shop America. We'll have a link to that in the show notes today. I think that anybody involved in the labor movement needs to check this out. It's absolutely so, so important. I know that locally in my own union, I'm going to start sending out copies to everybody that I can think of. I think everybody on our representative council, I think everybody in our on ABSCUFS, for example, Legislative Assembly, and every other union's representative body should be reading this guide in terms of thinking about how we actually organize and build power in this kind of like, you know, open shop America. So that's pretty amazing. And this becomes even more important after this week, Sean. I mean, you know, right. I mean, it's good. Right after we got done with the podcast, practically, we find that Anthony Kennedy has indeed basically is packing his bags to get out of here.
Yeah. I issued some of the most disastrous decisions in Supreme Court history and fucking leaves.
Yep, exactly.
Like, I don't think there's anything else that needs to be said after that.
No, you know, especially since, well, I don't want to get into this one. Yeah, because that guy doesn't even deserve it. There was a really good...
He cemented his legacy in the history books last week.
Yeah. Well, there was, you know, Sam Cedar in the Majority Report had Ian Millhiser last week. I think Rick might have had him on too as well. And talking about Kennedy's legacy and why he was actually given so much leeway had so much to do with the fact that nobody wanted to piss him off too much because he was their only hope. But that he was really kind of a disastrous justice. And now we're looking on Monday, supposedly, who the hell knows with Trump, but supposed to be announcing is going to be his pick. And
Roe v. Wade's going to be overturned.
Well, that's what it looks like.
And Susan Collins is not going to do a damn thing to stop it.
Exactly.
She's giving lip service, but like she's someone else. She's not doing a damn thing to stop. And, you know.
Well, like people have been saying, kind of lefty commentators have been saying, look, this is actually Susan Collins. This is gonna be the first time that she's actually going to have to, you know, she's been giving lip service to kind of protecting women's right to choose and Roe v. Wade. And now she's actually going to have to make a decision that has like enormous consequences. And so this is where the rubber hits the road. That's why there's people actually, I don't know if you saw this last week. There's people that have been sending hangers to Susan Collins' office. Right, wire hangers to Susan Collins' office, basically saying, "This is what is in store. This is what you have to choose. Are you going to choose for these hangers? Are you going to choose to go back to a time when women were going to have to go in the back alleys for abortion, for safe legal abortion, and now you're going to basically allow it to be criminalized statewide or nationwide?" This is it. And so, I would not rest at all on the hopes of Susan Collins. Basically defecting from the Republicans on this one, because most of her votes have been actually, you know, moving slowly in the direction of restricting a woman's right to choose, not supporting it. There's one woman on, and I guess who's made the short list. We should say the Federal Society, which is this kind of right wing legal think tank that's been around since, you know, got about 30 years or so, who has basically been, you know, basically the driving force behind the Republican agenda to take over all the courts, federal courts, up to the Supreme Court. I understand, Sean, we got to wrap it up. The Federal Society, they gave a list of like, I think, 25 potential choices to Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has basically been using that list to choose from. And the three finalists basically are coming from that list. And the one woman in particular, Amy Coney Barrett, you know, if this guy is smart, if Trump is smart, he's going to go after going to choose someone like her because she's a woman. Right. However, is a woman who has ruled against in the past, I guess, on the Seventh Circuit or something, basically saying that Roe v. Wade is kind of outdated. You need to get rid of it. So he's going to look to go after Roe v. Wade and go look at a way of kind of advancing our kind of a return to the 1890s.
And it's also the type of things that we're going to be seeing, like stuff like banning abortions at 20 weeks, you know, 20 week abortion ban, or not having, you can't abort a fetus that has Down syndrome, even though there's no way of figuring that out.
Right.
Or a 6 week abortion ban.
Right. It's crazy. It's crazy. Well, one thing before we go to the break, this came up in Sean's feed right before we were getting ready to record today. ProPublica out at a white nationalist.
Yes, who works for Northrop Grumman and is a UCLA doctorate student. And he still has his security clearances at Northrop Grumman.
Isn't that beautiful?
Even though they know who's getting out as a white nationalist.
Yep, this guy's name is Michael Macellus. Right. And he basically took part in a violent Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. And so far has not caused a problem with his standing at Northrop Grumman. And
he's also part of a white nationalist group that's been documented by ProPublica months ago. RAM. I don't know what their names are.
Rise Above Movement.
Yeah. What that is, it's basically like a fight club sort of movement where they show up to these rallies with the intention of fighting the other side.
Yep. And so here this in the ProPublica piece at the release is to say for months, ProPublica and Frontline have been working to identify the white supremacists at the center of the violent demonstrations across the country, including the infamous Unite the Right rally in August in Charlottesville. And the Rise Above Movement, a Southern California group that expresses contempt for Muslims, Jews and immigrants, became the focus of that effort. What they were able to find, this guy in particular, he's a RAM member. They saw he choked and bloodied a pair of female counter protesters. He was seen and and spotted combating people at the Trump rally in Berkeley. And it was also seen kind of throwing African-Americans to the ground and jumping and punching them. This is the kind of guy that we're saying has a government security clearance to work on sensitive materials for Northrop Grumman. There you have it. So check out that. You want to check out the whole report, just go to the links into the show notes for there. But, you know, this is the kind of stuff. I'm glad to see this kind of journalism taking place. ProPublica has always been has always done great work. So kudos to them. So remind everybody, if you want to support this kind of work here locally, right here in the state of Pennsylvania, grassroots, homegrown, progressive, pull no punch of journalism, become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/rcpress. You become a member today. We come back, we will get right into our Pennsylvania focus, everybody. Scamoni, editor and founder of Raging Chicken.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day known as Bloody Thursday. The historic West Coast maritime strike had been raging since May 9th. Longshoremen refused to cede to the Industrial Association, determined to open the ports by force. The shipping bosses had rejected strikers' demands, including a union hiring hall and recognition of offshore unions. By July 3rd, picketers had been fighting for hours to stop trucks sent to move cargo under police protection as bosses attempted to open the ports. At 8 a.m. on this day, a line of strike-breaking trucks emerged. Thousands of strikers amassed in the warehouse district. The Battle of Rincon Hill had begun. The fighting continued throughout the afternoon in the center of the Embarcadero as strikers attempted to stop the scab freight cars. By the time it was over, longshoreman Howard Speary and strike supporter Nick Bordeaux lay dead from police bullets. 30 strikers had been shot and dozens more lay in the hospital, some critically wounded. The San Francisco Chronicle reported, blood ran red in the streets of San Francisco. In Workers on the Waterfront, Bruce Nelson notes, quote, Bloody Thursday was an epic moment. Strikers conducted themselves with remarkable precision and imagination in the face of three successive assaults by police who were using their firearms freely and laying down a barrage of tear gas bombs. Donald McKenzie Brown, the businessman eyewitness, was overawed by the workers' insane courage in the face of bullets, gas, clubs, horse hooves, death, against fast patrol cars and the radio. They fought back with rocks and bolts till the street was a mass of debris. They were fighting desperately for something that seemed to be life for them.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. We got the PA focus going on right now. Sean, what do we got going on?
Dalen Leach went on a podcast funded by the Koch brothers this week.
Oh, I'm sure that was very helpful and actually helped convince a lot of people, these kind of moderate Republicans that are out there, that it's actually the Democrats are right.
Well, I think it's more like since you're a sexual harasser and you've been blacklisted from groups, you got to listen to someone who... I guess you got to talk to someone who's going to listen to you. And Matt Brea was the person who decided to sit down with Dalen Leach. And because we know Matt Brea has no morality, I would say, or foresight, that why not sit down with the person that really no one else wants to talk to, unless you're leadership in the Democratic Party.
But, well, there you go. Well, you know, This kind of move, you know, I this baffles me all the time, right?
It's so, like, yeah.
Why do we give this guy a platform?
Yes. So basically the thing is, Matt Brea, who was part of the Commonwealth Foundation, now is part of the Commonwealth Chamber of Entrepreneurs, these dark-minded groups that are funded by the Koch brothers, the Scaifes, and other, like, DeVosses and stuff like that, he has a podcast, and it's really amazing to see the chumminess he has with Democrats. You know, especially like people who are his ideology is to kneecap unions and to go after them and kneecap the people who are pushing for progressive ideas. Yet he keeps on bringing people like Jordan Harris and John Fetterman on. And the thing is, it's like, it's not that like these podcasts are worth going on and talking to, because really like no one listens to them. I guarantee you that this is probably Brea's like biggest catch, like the most listens, more than like 10 a week, probably, but he has these people on audio who will then, like, they're not going to be done in good faith, and then he'll be able to turn around and attack people with that months or years down the line.
Look, I also think, I think it's probably part of a fundraising pitch that he's got to as well, because he's like, look, look, we bring on, we're not a partisan organization. We don't have a specific political agenda. Look, we have Democrats on, and here's our list of people that we have on.
Yeah, so, I mean, it baffles my mind that these people want to go on there. And, you know, how we were talking about the last section where people saw Crowley as a chummy, good person. And I mean, people treat Breer the same way.
Yep. Which, and, you know, I think it comes from, you know, and again, these people that go on and organizations that support support these kind of platforms, they usually do this with this, you know, again, from my perspective now, this is kind of an outdated way of thinking about politics right now. They do it from this idea like, well, look, you know, we get to say what we want to say and we kind of get this out. We kind of engage. We'll engage everywhere. And it's kind of like an ahistorical reading of what these platforms are doing. Like, in many ways, these platforms, that helps to legitimize those platforms. I mean, I had this argument within my own union, kind of a few years back about the Susquehanna Valley Center for Public Policy, right? Which is basically one of these Koch brother funded kind of think tanks, right? That's kind of out there too as well. Not as prominent as the Commonwealth Foundation, right? But they get a whole bunch of money from these right wing dark money groups, right? And there's unions that support one of the programs on that show, right? Now, again, the guy, the one program, it's called what? Behind the headlines or something like this, behind the lines, something like this, where I think that, you know, that program itself is not a Koch brothers show. Right. However, that helps, and from my perspective, give legitimacy to behind the headlines, let's say, give legitimacy to that center itself, because that's where it's located. Right. And so why would we want to kind of support and gain legitimacy there? And if you want a program like that, right, if you're a union member, right, if you're kind of like a union or a progressive organization and you want that kind of platform and be able to go to it, guess what you need to do? You need to freaking fund the platforms, right, that are actually going to do it from a progressive end of things and not kind of like try to squeak in into these conservative think tanks. And we see the same kind of stuff. And this is the play state after state after state. Right. This is what they do. They sneak in these dark money groups. They sneak in. They set up as part of their state policy network and they fund these think tanks and organizations. And then they seek out these kind of like moderate voices or whatever like this or even voices from the left to include to help give them legitimacy so that they still count under a nonpartisan group when it comes to filing their taxes. I mean, this is kind of what the game is. And I think we're going to have to wise up to that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's all I want to say.
No, good. Well, this week, I mean, you know, like we said, we mentioned last week, we mentioned that this past weekend there was marches all over the country, and we had at least three reports from Raging Chicken Press from around the state around the region. Actually, we had Seth Goldstein, who was out there in Brooklyn. The Brooklyn Bridge march and protest was awesome. I was up in Wilkes-Barre and Sean was in Harrisburg. So, Sean, why don't you at least tell us a little about the Harrisburg rally and what was going on there?
Yeah, so the Harrisburg rally is actually pretty interesting. So, like, the rally was originally supposed to be planned for the Capitol steps, and they did not get the permits to go on the Capitol steps. So an organization, the local 3%er group, White Nationalists, they got the permits on the Capitol steps, and they wanted to have a meet and greet. And so, like, these are the people who had, like, the Charlottesville militia groups out there. Like your 3%ers, your far right groups, and they turned it into a meet and beat. They wanted to have a meet and beat with the Antifa because everyone who is against them is Antifa, even though these were nonviolent protesters. So the rally was changed at the last minute. There were no counter protesters there. The rally was switched like a half mile away, and we still got like 300, 400 people out there. And what was awesome about like this place is that it was like right near where in the area where I live, it's called the Sunken Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a garden. It's, you know, Sunken Gardens, and it has a nice gazebo in the middle of it. It's a really great.
Is that actually over near where the Dixon Center is, like behind that?
No. It's on the riverfront.
Oh, it's on the riverfront. Okay.
Yeah. So this was on the riverfront. It had a really nice like area back there. Is Italian Lake, I think.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
You know, 300 people showed up. They marched down to the governor's mansion and demanded the governor to shut down the Burke's detention facility. Immigration Family Center. And that was really a rallying cry across the state of Pennsylvania this past week. State Representative Chris Rabb was there. He said, we're going to shut it down. And not just the Berks Detention Center, but he wants people within the area to start coming in and shutting down committee meetings when these disastrous bills are trying to go through.
There you go, man. Doesn't get any clearer than that.
Yeah.
And if you haven't listened to Sean's audio of that he's got posted on the Facebook page there, I think we're actually going to cut that for some for a special podcast for next week, too, as well. Definitely check it out, because Chris Rabb kind of put the whole thing in context.
Yeah, Chris Rabb's awesome. I was unexpected to see him because he's from Philadelphia. And basically he said, if they ask me to come, I come.
Yep.
And he's like, I turn around. I saw Chris Rabb. I was like, Rabb, Chris, what are you doing here? What are you doing here, representative? He just looked at me. He's like, hey, they asked me to show up. I showed up.
Well, and that's just it. You know, and that's how he started off his talk, too, right? He's like, what am I doing here, right? This isn't my constituents. I'm not here for votes. This is not a fundraising campaign. What am I doing here, right?
Yeah, and the funny thing is it's like only 10 of those militia people showed up, the white nationalist group and everything. I mean, these are legit white nationalists. These are people who are part of the 3%er movement, and they try to say that they're not – white nationalists, but that's bullshit. They were vastly outnumbered and none of them showed up.
There you go. Well, I mean, it's something that is important for us to remember, right? Is that these extremist white nationalists,
we're not going to back down in the face of being threatened from white nationalists.
Right. Their perceived threat, in terms of kind of direct stuff diminishes greatly in the face of organizing. Right, is that once we organize collectively, like their power diminishes. It's only when we allow them to kind of dominate the space or dominate the debate or dominate the airways that they win.
Yeah.
Crazy. Well, I was up in Wilkes-Barre and, it was a fantastic event. Got to meet some of the organizers. All kudos goes out to Janice Walsh, who I interviewed. You may have seen it already, interviewed for Raging Chicken Press, and she was one of the organizers there, to Amanda Rowe, who did a spectacular job, bringing this whole event together. And it was kind of organized by NEPA for Change, or this Northeast PA for Change, great emergent organization. And you get to see a place like Wilkes-Barre, who has, long memory for when it comes to what a militant labor movement looked like at one time, about what it means to kind of like welcome immigrants into there. We had Eddie Day Pashinsky was there and talked about like his own family immigrants, right? And what that kind of meant historically. People kind of coming up and telling their family stories. A lot of people in the community basically saying, nope, I don't care. You can, even though that is a district that went for Trump in 2016. What organizers kept on telling me, what people I talked to in the crowd kept on saying, is that, yeah, that's not going to happen ever again. Right. People who made a mistake and got turned off and went home. That's not happening again because there's a resurgence that's going on. So amazing to be up there in Wilkes-Barre and having such a kind of strong, kind of energetic thing. And it was so freaking hot on Saturday. We should say that too, as well. To see so many people come out for this was amazing. What's that?
So we braved a heat wave too. I mean, it wasn't like it was 90 degrees. It was like 95 degrees with like real field temperatures, 105, 110 all day.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I walked about 2 miles with my gear, a bunch of water, and I was still, I had to come back and take a cold shower. I felt like I was going to vomit at that point. Like that's how hot it was outside.
It was.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was
nuts. Well, one of the things, if you haven't checked it out yet, again, I'm probably going to make this part of some special audio that we're going to release. But if you go to RagingChickenPress.org and you kind of look at my article on the Wilkes-Barre action, you're also going to see, as part of the video interviews I have, I've got one of Janice Walsh, who I interviewed, some of Eddie Day Pashinsky's speech, and then this Dr. Donna Hamilton, who is fantastic. And she had some good advice for people to talk about, the need to take care of each other. And she used this great metaphor. So you remember, if you're ever on an airplane, you're talking about going down, you got the flight attendant basically talks about, the oxygen mask come down, you put it on yourself first and strap it on before you help someone else. And she's using that same kind of principles, that's how we need to make sure we're taking care of ourselves. that we, you know, no one person is going to make this change happen, that we're going to have to do it by building kind of community and collectivity and taking care of each other, which was awesome to hear. But she also talked about what childhood trauma looks like and some of the discussions that she had with some of her, you know, doctor friends down at the border and what has actually happened to some of these kids that are being stripped away from their family. So do check that out, too, as well. I mean, she was pretty amazing. And we also had Seth Goldstein out there on the Brooklyn Bridge. Check out his pictures that are up there on Facebook. He's got some audio that he sent me too as well. To be honest, I hadn't had a chance to listen to it yet. I had a really sketchy internet connection over the past few days, so it kept on breaking up. I couldn't download it. But if I could pull some stuff out of that, once I listen to that, I'll set that up for some extra audio for next week too as well. So that was something else, to be sure. So kudos to everybody who was out there. And again, I just, this is like my little fantasy. Could only imagine if we could expand the operations of Raging Chicken Press, that we could have even more people on the ground across the state covering the actions that were happening everywhere. Because obviously there was lots of stuff happening in Philadelphia and Harrisburg. I mean, Sean was at their one in Harrisburg, but around the state. But imagine if we could have more people on the ground to highlight the work that is already being done by activists around the state.
And one of the things I think we got to talk about.
Yeah.
Not really his report. I actually had a back and forth with Will Bunch on this, is the amount of younger people that have been coming out to these rallies lately.
Yes.
I mean, like, they're not like coming out in the majority of the crowd, but there's a large plurality of younger people in these crowds. And, you know, Will Bunch had a tweet like, younger people have to get more involved in politics. You see everyone who's getting interviewed and these stories are in their 50s and 60s. I'm like, they're coming out. You, as the media, has to start interviewing these people. Mm-hmm. Instead of just talking to the older people, like in their 50s and 60s, it's your job to start interviewing these people and getting quotes from them. And, right now Will Bunch is tweeting out, he's down at the Occupy ICE Philadelphia location, which is expanded this week. There was 20 some arrests, you know, there's a bunch of, and he's talking to people, the 20 some year olds who were arrested down there last week and who have gone back the next day.
Yep.
So just want
to, good point. Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
So that was awesome. Families Belonging Together marches were amazing. And then meanwhile, that we've seemed to have some issues that are going around the Berks Immigration and Family Detention Center, a.k.a. the kind of, you know, the, you know,
it's
the
a nice hotel.
It's a hotel or it's a nice daycare. Right, Sean?
Yes. So one of the things Chris Rapp talked about, I put on Twitter, my Twitter account, the video, because you can't put up a 7-minute video on Twitter. So I cut out the last half of it. Last part of it when he's like talking about shutting down Berks, that we need to do that. Basically that he said, hey, a bunch of us are going to be going there Monday to see what this place is like. And I knew about this trip for a couple weeks now, talking to legislators, some of the more moderate Democrats, and they want to more like make it their response is to make it less bad. And so,
add some LED light fixtures or something like that.
Yeah, so one of the people who visited this place and has a history of documented abuse going back to 2015, with families being indefinitely detained there for about, I think, like a year or so or months at a time. Mm-hmm. We're only supposed to be there for a short periods of time. So Judy Schwenk, trademark, tone deaf. I didn't mean trademark. Yeah, but you know, gave an extremely really fucking tone deaf statement. Like unbelievably tone deaf statement on this. And she's one of the people, she said, it reminded me of the rooms of the daycare my granddaughter goes to. It didn't look like a horrific place where mistreatment is occurring. End quote.
Let that sit with you for a second, folks.
It reminded me of the rooms of the daycare my granddaughter goes to. It didn't look like a horrific place where mistreatment is occurring. Like, this is the place where families are being detained indefinitely. You know, this isn't daycare. Like, a daycare center, like, kids get to go home at the end of the day. These people are stuck in a minimum security prison.
Well, you know, it just baffles me how you can come away from that, like, in taking so out of context. It's like, yes, it is not, like, wire cages sleeping with space blankets on the floor, like we see happening at the border. Okay. So, but if that is our only points of comparisons, we say that and all we have, the only options that we have are the on off switch, good versus bad. You know, that is bad. This is not the same thing as, you know, the Berks detention is not the same thing as the bad. So it must be good. It's,
And it's basically what their thing is. And one of the things that they're talking about, like, well, what happens if we close it down? Where do the families go?
That's a good point, Sean. You know what? My whole argument about why we should shut it down is gone now because you said that where are they going to go? And so I said, stop thinking about it. And I think we should support the detention center. That's the argument, right? That's what.
Well, how about we don't have this fucking thing in our community?
Hey, how about that? How about we kind of actually do some serious kind of like work and kind of like change the way that we freaking deal with immigration stuff, as opposed to like, well, you got the nice prison as opposed to the not so nice prison. So why don't we just have nice prisons where we detain families indefinitely? How about that?
Yeah.
It's going on. And I have to say, you know, there's been the shutdown Berks. That's been going on for a while now.
For almost since before Trump was president.
Exactly.
And these officials or the people from Berks have been pressuring Governor Wolf for years now to file an emergency removal order, which, according to some of the activists, he promised them to do that in 2015, 2016, and he has not followed through on that promise yet.
There you have it. There you have it.
That is coming from some of the activists who have been pushing for this for years now, and they were promised this, and the governor promised not to do it. 25 legislators, Chris Rabin included, have signed a letter demanding an ERO. That would remove 24 families housed in the center.
Well, and you know, I think that too as well is you noticed that there was all these governors. We talked about this last week that started signing pledges, basically saying that no state resources are going to be used to support this detention policy and the separation against blah blah blah. And I think that you know the Berks Detention Center is one of the things that why we saw a little bit of delay on Tom Wolf and kind of some kind of careful languaging around this kind of stuff because you know worried about political fallout if. They actually go after and start to shut down the Berks Detention Center. So we are not going to be part of the harassment of huge segments of an immigrant population. We're not doing it. So part of it, right? So if you're looking for folks, people want to kind of get involved, want to find like locally, you know, you're not going to be able to get all the way down to the border. Berks Detention Center, right? The folks that kind of like shut down Berks, the work that they're doing provides a direct line right in our communities where this stuff has been going on for a while now. There we have it. So, Sean, take us through a little McGarrickle and our friend Barletta.
So yesterday in the middle of the heat wave, you know, sweltering heat wave, thanks to global warming. And, you know, this past week is what the future is going to be like. Like, this is what it's going to be like living in, like, you know, like all of the United States is going to have like the climate of Texas in the summertime because of climate change. And that we got to and we got a really good taste of that this past week.
Yeah,
I would say. Right. I mean, 98 degrees for 4 days in a row with heat indices up around like 110. McGarrickle, who helped push Libre's law through the final, like a bill that protects animal rights and everything. He was spotted riding on an elephant. An actual elephant. He is a Republican at the Springfield 4th of July march yesterday.
And the elephant is draped with this huge banner, right? It says like
Springfield Republicans on
it. Yeah, with the little Republican elephant like on it, just in case you missed the symbolism of him riding a freaking elephant, right?
Yeah.
There you go. That blew my mind. If somebody told me that, I would have been like, whatever. But there's the picture. Nope, actually happened.
I sent it to a state rep that I know. Their first reaction was, "This ain't real. GTFO." Like,
you know, I mean, this is like, the kind of thing where, okay, if you like, see this guy, like, what they should set up a huge movie screen as you enter the Capitol, right? And just play, like, have that picture being projected on that. This is what we're talking about, right? I mean, come on.
This guy's riding an elephant, the state senator. And he's another one of these union-backed Republicans from the Southeast that has a tough challenge this year around. So
there you go. Well, and meanwhile, Lou Barletta is basically, you know, he's going.
Pumping his white nationalist credentials.
Yeah, up in his white nationalist credentials and looking to make the internationalist play, huh?
Yeah, he invited Nigel Farage the architect of the Brexit movement as a fundraising ploy in Lackawanna County this past week. And, you know, this again, this falls right in line with Breitbart, how Breitbart is trying to take over European politics and fuel European nationalism and fascist groups over there. And, you know, he's one of the people that is hooked up with the Breitbart movement.
Yep.
I don't think there's anything else to say.
No, there you have it, folks. And, you know, again, if you need a reminder, all you have to do is draw like two dots to connect here. Okay. Like, so this is not a big leap. Like Lou Barletta, the anti-immigrant like guy from, you know, well-known.
I think mine is whiter than his teeth or his bed sheets.
Yeah, I love what you said. God, I wonder if I could set. What do you say? I wonder if I could
set my white balance to his teeth. Yeah. Hey, Lou, smile for me. I need to set up my white balance.
Oh my God! Right, just because you know whatever is like, you know, it's like, well, my skin's not quite white enough to be white, so I'm gonna have to offset that.
I think he actually goes through a like an actual teeth bleaching regimen. He has an actual regimen where he bleaches his teeth.
Like, this is just like bleach. Please tell me it's actual bleach.
I hope so. It might help us out in the long run. But like, he has a regimen where he bleaches his teeth. Like it's just some of these things you hear in Harrisburg. It might be a rumor. It might not be. Some people don't have teeth that white.
No. Oh, it's totally. I mean, come on. That's absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, my teeth are like almost stained yellow from drinking coffee every day, like an insane amount of coffee and other stuff.
There you go, man. So there you go. Lou Barletta making the internationalist play, the kind of white nationalist internationalist play. There you have it. Nothing like, you know, hooking up the kind of re-emergent fascist movements around the world. Lou Barletta right here in our backyard doing that with Nigel Farage. So last thing for today, before we kind of move on today's last call, I was thrilled by this. Is that, as you know, I've been covering the Colleen Bradley story now for years. And this past year, beginning back in in February, when Colleen Bradley got in touch with me, and I've been covering her case even more closely. We'll have a couple pieces that are be coming out soon. And did extensive interviews with her and the lawyers about her case, about her whistleblower case, about corruption and fraud in the state system of higher education, Pennsylvania state system of higher education. She was the former administrative budget director down at down at Westchester University, who blew the whistle on stuff that we've been reporting on Raging Chicken for a long time. And then she came up and, you know, from the administrative perspective and blew the whistle. Right. So her case right now, if you've been listening to the show before, you know, it's exhausted all of its kind of lower court stuff. And now they have a petition for a writ of certiorari. I'm always going to pronounce that wrong. To the Supreme Court to have her case be heard. Major implications for whistleblower rights and First Amendment rights at work. Has the potential of like dramatically narrowing the rights of public sector workers, 30 million plus public sector workers across the country, if the Supreme Court refuses to hear this case and allows a lower court decision to be heard. That's the short of it, right? So, you know, I feel like for a long time I've been writing kind of like into the wilderness in so many ways. And I've been pretty much astounded that the fact that this case has not been picked up by, you know, groups, for example, like the ACLU, groups like the Rockefeller Center, who basically, who've been doing work on stuff, even some of the national whistleblower rights thing. You know, I've tweeted this article out. I've sent them information, sent folks email. Nobody seems to want to kind of like really it's felt like nobody sees the kind of importance.
But also the ACLU is hung up with other things right now.
No, I get that, right? And that's been part of the problem about this case, right? There's lots of stuff that is going on, and we've seen resources stretched thin. Still, you'd think that there'd be some folks, right, at least in Pennsylvania media, that would be kind of like noticing how important this case is potentially. Now, again, I know a lot of public sector unions and this kind of stuff. They've been worried so much about Janus that their direction is focused in that that direction. Anyways, big news this week. I've been back and forth talking to some folks. Kudos to Jerry Carbo. He's a professor out there in Shippensburg. He and a bunch of other faculty members have got up to speed on this stuff. have been independently also in touch with Colleen Bradley after kind of reading a bunch of stuff on Raging Chicken's hearing stuff on this podcast, reading the stuff on Raging Chicken Press, and deciding, hey, what can we do about this? And so they are organizing right now to basically, as a group of faculty members, to file an amicus brief, right, in support of Colleen Bradley's petition for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court. And they are raising money so that they can get that amicus brief written, right? They have a goal now of $1,200. They are already, that's only been active for 2 days. They're already at $450 towards their goal. And I want to kind of give them a huge plug. Go check it out. This is, if you go to gofundme.com/stand-up-for-whistleblower-rights. That's what it is. If you just go to GoFundMe and stand up for whistleblower rights, you're going to get there, or just go to the show notes and kind of click on that and check it out. If you can make a donation, you know, make $5, $10. There's several people that have already donated $100 towards this goal because they recognize how important this is. Please go check this out. And I want to thank them too, as well, for as they put this stuff up, the first thing that that shows up on that page says, help us protect whistleblower rights. And they have a direct link to Raging Chicken Press interview with Colleen Bradley. Please go and check this stuff out. It's super important. If you can spare some money to kind of donate towards this cause, please do. But all kudos goes to Jerry Carbo and the other faculty and kind of other folks that are volunteering to get this out of the ground and helping spread the word is all the more important. So thank you guys so much. And Colleen, she and I went back and forth a little bit about this. She's super excited about this. And we got our fingers crossed this is actually going to get heard by the Supreme Court and that we're going to be able to start to push back against the erosion of our First Amendment rights at work. So have at it. All right. Anything else before we move on, Sean?
Nope. I don't have anything.
Nope. Sean just stuck his thumbs in his ears for some reason. All right. So anyway, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Want to remind you, support this work, support this podcast, support the work we do at RagingChickenPress.org by becoming a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/rcpress. Become a member today. We'll be right back with today's last call. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull-no-punches, progressive reporting and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight. Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is the last call. I mentioned this on the beginning of the show today, but the kind of like raising a glass to a good friend of mine, old friend of mine, Ben Tesler, who died unexpectedly this week. Guys younger than I am, lived in New York, had two little kids. His one daughter just celebrated her bat mitzvah last week, and it's been a real shock. Ben was too young, but rest in peace, Ben. I don't know what to tell you. it's like one of these moments, right? You kind of see, you know, people that were part of your life. And, you know, Ben and I, you know, periodically be in contact back and forth through Facebook, just here and there, just kind of small exchanges. But I know, like, you know, he was one of my college roommates. We lived together for a while. My other friend, Mike Harrison, who's was really close to Ben. He basically had the, you know, burden of sending us the news of Ben's passing this week. And so, you know, our thoughts are with everybody. I mean, I think that there's our little community, you know, our little Syracuse punk community, like an alternative community, are feeling it hard this week. And it's, you know, for anybody who's listening to this from that, you know, we're raising a glass to you, Ben, on today. So there's that. I know it's not the best way to, you know, close this out. I mean, I know it's a serious note and I know it's a sad note. Yeah, it is what it is. So next week, I'm going to have that in mind. So, you know, we're going down. I should say this too, as well, a programming note. Next week, we are not going to have our regular scheduled podcast. We're going to have some special audio. Hopefully that'll be up and running for everybody. I'm going to be going down to the shore with my family for the week. And, it's just, Sean and I tried this 1 year, I think, and the Wi-Fi was just not great. And it ended up being more of a headache than anything else. So instead of giving you a kind of like, you know, a half-ass show as well, we'll just kind of give you some special audio for the week. And we'll come back in full force in 2 weeks. And we'll see what's going on there. But while I'm down there, one of the things that I'm going to be doing is there's 7 Mile Brewery, which is on kind of Rio Grande, New Jersey. It's kind of outside Wildwood. The 7 Mile Brewery, I was there last time. It's great stuff. You get a chance, you're down the Wildwood area anytime. Take the, you know, few minute drive outside of Wildwood, go to 7 Mile Brewery, and they've got some great kind of, you know, beach drinking beer, you know, a whole bunch of kind of light stuff, kind of more, you know, light stuff, not really some of the heavy, you know, stouts and that kind of stuff, if you like it. But this time my goal is also to make it down to Cold Springs Brewery, also in Cape May. They've got they have a tap room that's kind of comes out of this barn that I've always wanted to go to and just haven't made it down there yet. So hopefully I'll be able to report back on that. And also in Cape May Brewery, Cape May Brewing down there in Cape May. We'll kind of bring some news of that back on too as well. So other thing I want to give a shout out to is that at Free Will, this kind of went unnoticed for a bit. Didn't get the same kind of play as some of the other sours that got released, but they had a Creek Nouveau that came out. Am I saying that right? Creek. Okay. And they sent out some bottles early on, and they're getting ready to make the second batch of it. But I love this stuff, man. It's a nice sour, nice cherry sour. And here's how they describe it. 3,000 pounds of fresh off the tree, local tart cherries from Weiser Orchards Farm Market. They're going into the tank. We're going to re-ferment a 3-year-old barrel of barrel aged sour ale along with it. And they're putting everything in there, leaves, stems, pits, orchard, microbes, everything to give it that super funk. And so that's sour that is starting there, that next batch of it. There are still some bottles of the sour available at Free Will. I just picked up a couple more bottles this past week. So if you're down there, check that out. They also have a kind of some 5th of May left. They also have some of the kind of the berry one. So, yeah, go check it out. Some good stuff. So anything for the last call for you, Sean? Cool stuff going on? Thoughts happening here? Cool pictures you're taking?
No, I got some awesome pictures from the women or the Keep Families Together March last week.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah. Not really pat myself on the back a little bit for that.
He literally just patted himself on the back for it. So if we only had video.
Yeah, nothing really happened beer wise out here.
No, just any kind of news you might have. Sean really spent a lot of time, and I think you're gonna have to stop doing this, Sean, but you're gonna have to stop spending so much time looking for Wagner mowing lawns. I think that's you spent way too much time this week trying to track him down, and missed him.
I might actually get to see Wagner at some point this week.
Yeah. I hope so. That'd be awesome.
I don't know. Maybe they stop me before I get to shake his hand. I don't know.
I just hope, I hope he doesn't have his tractor with him. Right. So I hope it,
he doesn't like mow me over.
Well, yeah, exactly. So you never know. Go John Deere. Oh, we'll see. Anyway, so yeah, so Sean, you know, it'll be 2 weeks, man. I just can't imagine 2 weeks between podcasts. I think, you know, who knows if the country is still going to be here by the time we get back at the pace that things are going. But
I might be putting a camp. I'm not sure.
You might be what?
Putting some sort of camp with the censors.
There you go.
Yeah.
The anti-lefty media camp, which is currently being constructed, right? Crazy. Anyways, so, yep, who knows? Maybe we'll get we'll find out that anyone with the wrong political opinions will have their citizenship stripped from them if they're, they don't want to sign a loyalty pledge or something like this. We go back. So who knows where we're going to go. Anyways, I'm going to wish everybody a happy couple of weeks. I hope that the weather breaks a little bit so it's not too crazy hot out there. Look for some special audio coming up. Also, going to have to say that we originally planned, Colleen Fitzgerald and I planned on doing the Free Range podcast. We're going to release the next one next week. That may or may not happen. She and I might try to get one done from the shore if the Wi-Fi is all right. I'm highly skeptical of it, though. I'm giving the past track record heading down there and looking at the Wi-Fi connection. So you might get that early the following week, but look out for there. Also, we're going to have a little preview. I screwed up some of the audio, but it's a little preview of what we'll be talking about coming out soon, too, as well. So Sean, happy heat, I guess.
Yeah, the heat's going to be breaking this week.
can only hope.
I cannot wait.
All right, man. So, all right, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, and have the best. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Want to remind you, once again, become a member of Raging Chicken for a little $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/RCPress and become a member today. All right, everybody, I'm out of here. Going to go catch some waves, drink some beer. Right. Try to remember what it was like to be a human being. See ya!